What if the very people meant to guarantee justice in your country carried invisible biases into the courtroom? Would independence alone be enough to guarantee fairness? I'm Ashley of FraxBiz.com, and welcome to today's episode, where we unravel the tangled roots of judicial independence, bias, and diversity in the United Kingdom. Today, we'll dig into why judicial independence is more than just a legal firewall. It's a living, breathing achievement shaped by politics, people, and power. If you've ever wondered why public confidence in the courts wobbles, or why diversity statistics for judges make headlines, you're in the right place. Here's our roadmap. First, we'll break down what judicial independence really means in the UK. Then, we'll explore how bias isn't just about overt prejudice, but about unconscious patterns shaped by who gets to wear the robes. We'll dive into eye-opening data on ethnicity and religion within the judiciary, and finally, we'll tackle what true impartiality demands in the modern era. Along the way, I'll use terms like structural biases. Think of it as the current beneath the surface, not just a rock in the stream. And when I mention institutional design, picture the blueprints of a building set to withstand storms, not just the paint on its walls. So, let's get started. How did judicial independence become the constitutional bedrock of the UK, and why is that only half the story? How did the UK shift from a system where Parliament called the shots to one where courts regularly scrutinise government action? The answer lies in a constitutional evolution over the past two decades. Traditionally, the UK relied on what's known as a political constitution. Picture a football match where referees are also part-time coaches, Parliament and ministers held each other to account. But since the early 2000s, the country has moved to a more legalistic approach, where judges step in as independent referees, especially through judicial review. The Constitutional Reform Act 2005 is a watershed. It birthed the UK Supreme Court, overhauled the Lord Chancellor's role, and forced ministers to safeguard judicial independence in law. However, independence isn't static. Academic Turen argues the Act also brought new headaches, think administrative overload, and the rising expectation to handle thorny human rights issues. It's like giving a referee more rules and a bigger stadium, but expecting the same flawless performance under brighter lights. So if independence is now a moving target shaped by relationships and resources, not just legal rules, are we doing enough to protect the system from political and practical pressures? Let's get real. Can legislative reforms alone insulate judges from all pressures? Academic research, especially the work of G and colleagues, suggests judicial independence is more political achievement than legal formula. Now you might be thinking, isn't a statute enough? But picture judicial independence as a delicate ecosystem. Sure, fences keep out some predators, but the health of the system depends on daily interactions, dialogue, respect, and yes, sometimes, negotiation between judges and politicians. Interviews with 150 constitutional insiders reveal that independence thrives on mutual understanding rather than rigid boundaries. Think statutory duty as the scaffolding, but institutional culture as the cement holding it together. The upshot? Independence isn't just about resisting overt interference. It needs constant vigilance, institutional support, and a willingness to adapt to new pressures, whether that's political heat or administrative overload. So, as we move forward, ask yourself, how can we ensure independence isn't just enshrined on paper, but lived out in every decision and every relationship? When we hear judicial bias, most people picture a judge with a personal stake in a case. But is that the real threat? Academic Mallison argues bias is often baked deep into the system, not just the result of an individual judge's leanings. Let's break it down. The law tests for bias using the so-called fair-minded and informed observer standard, but critics say this is a legal fiction, a stand-in for majority norms. It's like asking a fish to judge whether the water is wet. Now, imagine entering a courtroom where every judge shares similar educational, social, and cultural backgrounds. Barnes and Mallison call this a judicial identity blackout. On the surface, judges appear neutral technicians, but their worldviews are shaped by shared experiences. Structural bias isn't about bad actors or misconduct, it's about a system replicating itself unconsciously. Diversity, then, isn't just window dressing, it's a real-life firewall against homogenous thinking. So, next time you hear about judicial bias, ask not who's on the bench, but who isn't, and why that matters for justice. Let's talk numbers, because representation matters. The latest statistics reveal striking gaps between the UK's judiciary and its public along lines of ethnicity and religion. Only 10% of court judges and just 5% of senior judges are from ethnic minorities, while ethnic minorities make up 18% of the working age population. That's up to a 13-point deficit where it counts most, in the senior court shaping constitutional law. Religion shows a similar gap. 74% of judges are Christian, against just 46% of the population. Muslims make up only 1% of the bench, but 6.5% of the public. That's six times less representation. When you consider how religion can frame perspectives on family, morality, or social norms, or live issues in courtrooms, the impact is clear. Institutional representation is the technical term for this gap. Think of it like having architects who've only ever lived in one neighbourhood designing an entire city. Perspective matters. So, what does this say about impartiality? Are our courts truly reflecting the population's values, or are they shaped by an unintentional echo chamber? Is recusal or appellate review enough to guarantee a fair hearing? Modern scholarship says no, impartiality needs to be engineered at a systemic level, not just police case by case. Let me tell you about some solutions. Transparent, diversity-sensitive appointments, unconscious bias training, and robust institutional support for judges facing political storm clouds. These aren't just buzzwords, they're the circuit breakers that keep the system honest. Imagine a judiciary as a feedback loop. If the same voices echo, the system risks stagnation. But introduce diversity, and you foster what academics call cognitive pluralism, a richer, more resilient approach to justice. Now, you might be asking, won't too much diversity undermine independence? But the evidence suggests the opposite. Independence and diversity are two sides of the same constitutional coin. Without both, the system wobbles. So, as we look forward, are we ready to design a judiciary that not only insists on independence, but also embraces the full spectrum of society it serves? Let's recap. First, we learned that judicial independence is more than statutory insulation. It's a dynamic political achievement. Second, we exposed how structural bias can persist beneath the surface and why diversity isn't just cosmetic, it's a constitutional safeguard. Third, we saw that impartiality isn't guaranteed by tradition alone. It demands thoughtful institutional design. If you're wondering what you can do, here's a concrete step. Stay informed and demand transparency about who sits on the bench. Engage in conversations about judicial appointments in your community. These dialogues shape public confidence. Are you thinking, but can the system ever truly be unbiased? Remember, as the academics say, bias can't be eliminated, but it can be managed. The future hinges on a judiciary that adapts and recognises its own vulnerabilities. If you found today's episode thought-provoking, subscribe, share, or send in your questions. Justice is everyone's business. Let's keep the conversation going.